Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Tom Kane of Harvard University joins us to discuss variations in pandemic learning loss and how students across multiple demographics experience similar declines within the same school district. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber discusses a New York City study that investigates the effects of external principal hires and internal principal promotions on various measures of school quality. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Well, with other people's studies, you know. Now, Fordham studies, regardless of where we do them, clearly have national implications.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Tom Kane. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's great to have you on. Tom is the Walter H. Gale Professor of Education and Economics and Faculty Director of the Center for Education Policy Research at Harvard University. Whew! That is a good one, Tom.
I have Walter H. Gale to thank for that.
Okay, good. Hey, we've got to thank our benefactors. It's fine. Well, Tom is here to discuss his recent New York Times article called "Parents Don't Understand How Far Behind Their Kids Are in School." That was co-authored with Sean Reardon, and his work on the Education Recovery Scorecard Project. So, in other words, we are going to talk about learning loss. Let's do that on Ed Reform Update. All right. Well, Tom, this is a show that cares about learning loss. We do not debate whether or not we should call it that or, whether we should be concerned about it. We're happy to call it that. Whatever gets the point across to people that we have a serious problem out there in the wake of this horrible pandemic, that a lot of kids are way behind where they otherwise would be academically, and that is a problem and we need to fix it. And I think you would agree with that, right? This is
absolutely, Mike. Actually, the reason why we did this, and many of your listeners will have heard the results when the NAEP came out back in October, suggesting that achievement declined, so forth. And the reason why we did this was to make the story local, because the impacts really did vary significantly by local community. So, like, you could be in Ohio and see that the average district in Ohio lost a little bit more than a half a year worth of math achievement, which is pretty close to the national average, honestly. And you might think, well, gosh, okay, everybody's down, but you'd miss the fact that Cleveland, Canton, Columbus City, Akron, Springfield, Toledo City all lost more than a year. While, other districts like Dublin City, Lakota Local, Worthington City, Sylvania Schools, Mason City, all lost less than a quarter of a year. So it's not that all the districts in Ohio were in the same boat. Some communities lost a lot more than others.
Yeah, and this is what you're doing with the Education Recovery Scorecard. So you're able to combine the NAEP scores with local test scores to be able to give us that picture. And it's really powerful. I encourage people to check it out. But let's dig right in. You mentioned the Ohio example. Thank you. As a lot of our listeners know, Fordham cares deeply about Ohio, our home state. And if you couldn't tell, you were rattling off at first a lot of high poverty districts that had lost more than a year, and then some more affluent districts that had lost maybe more like a quarter of a year. And yet, when you read the New York Times article, one of the things that stands out, kind of counterintuitive finding that you had nationally, was that affluent kids in districts that were closed for a long time, they have fallen behind quite a bit, just like poor kids have. The conventional wisdom is that, well, this pandemic was bad, but it was especially bad for poor kids, kids of color, white, Asian, affluent kids, maybe lost a little ground, but not that much. That's oversimplifying. Is that what you're saying?
It is, Mike, and this is one of the more surprising things in what we've seen. In fact, I can't remember the last time I saw this pattern, and I think it has something to do with mechanisms. So you're right. People should amend the way they describe what the pandemic's impacts were. What the pandemic did was students in lower income districts, students in districts with higher percentage of African-American students lost a lot more ground on average than districts that were primarily higher income students. But when a district lost ground, all the subgroups in that district lost about the same amount of ground on average. I'm sure there's exceptions out there, but that was the national picture we saw. And I think that says something about mechanisms, like where I think it's saying it was something about the quality of the remote hybrid instruction, student attendance during that remote hybrid instruction, either leading teachers that continue to repeat themselves over the course of the semester, and community level factors like, you know, the level of disruption in social and economic life in a community, rather than individual household differences driving these. We think it was more these kinds of district level and community level.
All right. Well, one mechanism you didn't mention, though, is the obvious one, right? It's about closures. Right? How long were they closed to in-person?
I totally agree. And I didn't mean to leave that one out. There were two reasons why high African-American school districts lost more, at least two reasons. Number one, schools were more likely to be closed. So the higher poverty districts stayed closed for longer. And when they stayed closed, the loss per week was larger in those districts. That there were some higher income districts that stayed closed for long periods, but when they did, they lost considerably less than the high poverty districts did.
Yep. All right. That makes sense, you know, which is not to take any attention away from the fact that kids in, say, the poorer kids in high poverty districts are the kids who probably, you know, lost the most. But it is to say that if Americans, we have this propensity to hear bad news about education and assume it's about somebody else's child.
Right.
And here you're trying to say, wake up, parents. You know, this is very much about your kid. I mean, I'll take it very personally, right? Montgomery County, Maryland, where my sons go to school, closed to in-person learning for 13 months, then opened up for every other week of instruction in that second year of the pandemic. So, you know, you're saying that it is likely that the kids in that kind of a district, everybody lost ground, not just the poor kids, right?
That's right.
And therefore, we've got to figure out about how to get everybody caught up. Tom, let me ask you, because you've been thinking about this for so long, and I feel like it's one of the most fundamental questions I get all the time. I'd love to hear how you answer it. And you mentioned it earlier. Oh, well, everybody's down, right? Some people would say, well, look, if everybody lost some ground, then my kid's no worse off than other people. It'll all wash out. They'll get into just to go to college or it'll be fine, right? It's the relative performance that matters. What's wrong with that line of thinking?
Mike, here are two reasons why that's wrong. Is even within states, so I was just going through the districts in Ohio, Cincinnati, Cleveland, kids in those districts lost a lot more than the average student in Ohio. And so in Maryland, the kids in Baltimore lost a lot more than the average kid in Maryland. And so they will be competing for slots in college and in jobs with people from these other districts in the state that saw much smaller losses. Like here in Massachusetts, I live in Newton, one of the higher income, you know, suburban districts. I wouldn't be surprised if the Newton and Natick and Wellesley students are back to 2019 levels this spring. I would be very surprised if the students in Boston and Lawrence and Lynn, which lost more like a year, will be close to 2019 levels. So that's one issue. The second is, remember, not every state stayed closed as long as Maryland, the average school in Maryland did. You know, there were some states that saw much smaller losses overall. Now, your students are going to be competing with for college slots with them, too.
That's right. And look, and some of this is also just about a basic principle. We want kids to fulfill their academic potential, right? I mean, it's a shame to leave any of that potential on the floor. It just means that, you know, they might not be able to go as far in higher education as they like, or if they're going into a more of a career orientation after high school, you know, they might not be able to take as high a level of skilled trade job as they otherwise could, right? If they just haven't mastered the math, or they just don't have the vocabulary, or they can't, you know, read the technical manual in a way that they otherwise would have, that means they have less opportunity.
Yeah. So, Mike, we actually tried to, in another paper at this Education Recovery Scorecard site, we tried to put some numbers on the potential costs. So to do so, what we did was we looked back at states, kids born in states that saw big increases in the NAEP between 1990 and the late 2000s. And we looked at, okay, what happened to the incomes of kids born in those states over time versus the incomes and educational attainment and teen motherhood rate of kids born in states that saw much smaller increases in the NAEP over that time period. And so we just said, okay, using this same test, what were the consequences for earnings? And just applying that to say, okay, given this loss, what should we expect for earnings? And we estimate that over the course of people's career, the average student in the U.S. will lose about $20,000 in present value of lifetime earnings. That's not per year. $20,000 per year would be extremely large, but this is $20,000 over their career. Now, you might say, well, gosh, that's not such a big deal. But if you multiply it by like 48 million students who were enrolled in K-12 during the 2021 school year, that's about $900 billion across the U.S. So, and as I said, the losses will be constant to be even larger in the places like Cleveland and Canton and, you know, areas that saw much larger losses.
Yeah. All right. One last question, Tom. It's, of course, the big one. And so we're not going to have enough time to talk about it, but what to do? You are worried that we are not doing enough and that the scale of this problem, especially, again, for, say, the Daytons of the country, that where the kids were already way behind, now they're even further behind, that we are not thinking big enough to close this gap.
Right. So I think, Mike, we should be thinking in two categories, one short term and one, you know, medium term. In the short term, we've got to sign up as many students as possible for summer learning. This summer and next summer, we've got 15 more months to spend the federal pandemic recovery. So summer learning should not be the exception. It should be the norm in districts that lost a lot of ground this summer and next summer. We also ought to be investing in vacation academies. I wish more school districts were talking about extending the school year. I realize that's politically difficult. I think that's part of the reason why it's politically difficult is I think parents are underestimating the magnitude of their losses. I would hope that we'll see more of that going on in the next year. But I also hope people are thinking longer term or medium term. Obviously, students in Canton, Cleveland, Columbus will not have caught up by the end of next year. And we ought to be talking about what kinds of policy changes are necessary, given that students will not have caught up. So should there be a fifth year of high school that is optional for students, you know, or should we pick certain grades where we provide intensive resources to help students catch up, where there's a lot of tutoring in math and reading, for instance, in ninth grade. One of our problems, or one of the challenges I think school districts have had in responding to this, is they're trying to reinvent instruction in every grade, in every subject, trying to help catch up. And that's just think about that as a managerial problem. And instead, if we focused a lot of those resources on a couple of grades, on a couple of subjects, and just said, look, here's the firewall. When kids reach this point, we're going to make sure that they help catch up, and we're really going to concentrate and do a good job in helping students when they reach ninth grade, help them catch up. Like we've got to be thinking longer term, because this definitely will not be over by the end of next spring. Students will not have caught up. And it's going to take a while to put these policy changes into effect. So we should get started now.
Well said. Sobering though it may be. All right. Well, Tom Kane, thank you so much for joining us. Again, people should check out the New York Times article, Parents Don't Understand How Far Behind Their Kids Are in School, and also the Education Recovery Scorecard Project. And it really is helpful and interesting and important to drill down and to see what this learning loss looks like district by district. So, Tom, thanks so much for coming on the show. Hope you come back sometime soon. Maybe next time we'll have better news.
Thanks, Mike. I hope so.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
I'm flying solo here this week.
I know. David's in France. Aren't we jealous?
France. Look at that. I know. Are we violating his privacy by telling people he's in France? Well, it's a big country.
It is. It is a big country. And yeah, it's nice when you get to go to a place like that for your 2-week vacation, I gotta
and
say.
Yes, he's got family over there. So it is that is legit. He's got to bring the kids over to see family. And I guess we'll get some probably some reports on the back end about what it was like to do a transatlantic flight with two tiny children.
Yes.
I'm sure great.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it was. And yeah, I'm sure everybody on the plane was just so happy too, especially the people sitting behind them.
All right. So let's do this research thing. It's just me this time. I'm going to try to be as wonky as I can in my questions.
All right. We have a new study conducted in New York City. It's looking at the impact of principal attrition and replacement on a bunch of different qualities of school quality. So they're looking at teacher turnover, student achievement, student growth. We know that other studies have found that, you know, these things are bad. If you're going to have a transition, just like a teacher transition, a principal transition can be disruptive on multiple levels. But the study adds a couple new wrinkles. One, it looks at school environment and climate, which are measures that we don't typically have. And I think most folks know that New York City does this annual school climate survey for teachers that researchers like to use sometimes. And the second new wrinkle it adds is it examines whether the extent of the impact of a principal transition varies depending on whether the principal was an internal hire, meaning it was filled by someone who previously was a teacher or assistant principal in that school, or an external hire, meaning filled by someone who never worked within that school. There were a small number of principals who had once worked at a different school in New York City, and they were excluded. And charter schools, by the way, are not in here either. So it's just TPS, traditional public schools. So this is Marcus Winters, Brian Casita, Aki Cho. Those are our analysts here. They use longitudinal administrative data for all principals, again, in TPS in the city from 2006-07 to 17-18. On average, I'll give you, David's not here, so you get a quiz all by yourself. How many on average New York City schools replace close to what percentage of traditional public schools every year?
Yeah, especially during that time period. Let's see, that would still be in the early years, at least the Bloomberg years. I'm going to say they replace 15% of principals every year.
Not too bad. It was more like 10%.
Mm, okay.
And that's lower than national statistics, so... more than half of them had never previously worked as a principal within New York City, and about a third were promoted from within the school. All right. So again, looking at the effect of school transitioning from one principal to another relative to having an established principal for 5 years. That's your comparison. I'm going to just do a little bit on the wonky methods. Since school attributes can bias the findings, they leverage the variation across schools in the timing of their principal changes. So in other words, since schools experience these changes at different time periods, the introduction of a new principal is not likely to be associated with policy changes or other factors that affect all the schools at once. But they also look at parallel trends for schools that are X number of years away from experiencing a transition or that don't have a transition at all. And they hold constant whether the school experienced that transition within the 5 previous years. And they do find that these patterns are consistent with parallel trends. So all of which says this bodes well for the study design in terms of how they're conducting the study. All right. Key findings: changing the principal has an immediate negative impact on growth and proficiency that remains over several years, regardless of whether the new leader was hired internally or externally. For example, the decline in student progress in the first year following a principal change is about 0.2 standard deviation on their metric. Analysts do not see a change in teacher turnover during the first year following a principal transition. However, following the transition to an externally hired principal, again, not to an internal hire, they see a significant increase in turnover in the second year, both overall and among teachers with 5 or fewer years of experience. Likewise, for their measure of school environment, in this case, that covers things like trust and order and a school vision, there's a decrease of about 0.3 standard deviation after a school transitions to an external hire, but again, not to an internal hire. The negative effect for this external hire lessens over time, but it's still significant up to 5 years later. But then they have a pretty good discussion section trying to figure out the relationship between these things. They say that, you know, maybe their results are suggesting that a principal's impact on student learning is distinct from their impacts on school environment and working conditions, at least according to teachers. They also say that maybe the teacher turnover came as a consequence of the decline in the perceived working conditions because they witnessed a pattern where the teacher satisfaction scores went down during that external leader's first year, and then it was followed by an increase in turnover in the fall of that external leader's second year. So all of which I think is it got me thinking about just different like value added models and sometimes how we see they're not as stable when you're looking at something like SEL versus academic achievement. So it is possible that we're measuring different things here in terms of these outcomes. So your thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, pretty sobering, right? I mean, just the general negative findings here on, you know, that you change the principal and achievement goes down. Maybe that was known already. That had escaped my attention. You know, reminds me of school closures where we know, at least when kids close a school for low performance, that maybe in the first year or two, the kid's performance goes down. Likewise, school choice in the first year or two, there's transition costs, right? But in these other examples, at least by some studies, then there's a rebound. You know, it's kind of a short-term pain for long-term gain. And I don't hear you reporting that in this case.
Right. That's right. It kind of hangs in there.
Of course, makes me wonder, like, were they replacing decent principals with worse principals, at least in New York City during this time period? I mean, I do remember, it was a while ago now, but there were a lot of criticisms about the Bloomberg administration's approach to principal development. You know, they had this corporate style and leadership training program that was led literally by people who are not educators for the most part. And I think they hired a lot of super young educators to go through that program and then to become principals. So is it just in New York that they really botched it on the principal development pipeline? Or is this a lesson for other places too, that we got to really be careful and maybe you're often better off giving a principal a chance to stay for a longer time, maybe get better at what they're doing? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that your point is well taken about New York City. I mean, I think it's hard to say what the marketplace looks like for, you know, leadership talent in other places. And it could be that it's, you know, it's very different in New York City, whether that's better or worse. So I don't think, you know, these can necessarily apply to other places. But I don't know, I guess I'm struck by, you know, it seems like for a long time, we had this idea that if you were, you know, a business leader or you were outside of education, right? And maybe this part of the Bloomberg mentality that, you know, you'd be more likely to shake things up, try new things. You know, you weren't stuck in some of the old ways or, you know, you were just going to be more of a risk taker. And so, yeah, whether that's at least when it comes to teachers' views on the environment and the school culture, they're not too happy with those new folks. And yeah, you do wonder if they really give them a chance because you're seeing this negative impact, whether or not you're a newbie or you're an internal hire.
Yeah. And I don't know. Look, I think that the idea that we need people from outside education running schools might have been one of those dumb ideas. I mean, I know at Fordham, we promoted that at times. Certain people who will remain unnamed. Look, I think we're in a place now where there's a lot more respect for the need to have curricular and instructional expertise.
That's right. That's right.
A principle that educators can look up to and say, okay, this person did my job before and was really good at it and can teach me about how I might do it well as also. Now, I think especially say elementary schools tend to be smaller. You know, if you're talking about a huge high school, those principles are so far away from a classroom, maybe it's a little bit different. And my understanding in this study is they're looking at all of the schools in New York City, right? Including some that were pretty good. And that, so it still may be the case that when you're talking about low performing schools that have been dysfunctional, you know, you need to shake things up and changing the principle can be part of that.
Right. I mean, the larger discussion that we had for like a minute was that we need to break up this job, you know, sort of like how we're talking about teachers, where you could have a principal that was the instructional leader, you know, or do we expect them to be the instructional leader, really, and do all the other sort of administrative stuff and discipline and, you know, operations, or does it make sense to have an instructional leader, you know, do those things? And it still feels like we're trying to do the superhuman thing with principals that we do with teachers.
Yep. But good. I mean, look, we've got to learn that this might be one indication that our instinct to take action, you know, sometimes we've got to be patient. And, you know, if somebody can have a long run as a principal and they're pretty good, that's going to be better than a lot of turnover.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Again, maybe, at least in New York City during that time period.
During that time. There you go. You're learning about these limitations and caveats.
Oh, yeah. Well, with other people's studies, you know. Now, Fordham studies, regardless of where we do them, clearly have national implications.
Always. Apply everywhere.
Yes. All right. Good stuff, Amber. Appreciate it. Important topic. So that is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm Amber Northern.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C., For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.